Good morning and welcome to the seventh or maybe eighth or sixth, I don't know, podcast of the First Universalist Unitarian Church of Wausau. My name is Brian Mason and I serve this congregation as minister. And this morning I am joined by Donica Kozlovich, Margaret Jers, and Julie Trombley. And I am happy to report that we are all footloose and Lysol free. And I hope that all of you are too. Bear in mind that we are still in the safer at home measures, and so the vast majority of our communication happens online. And so if you haven't subscribed to our newsletter or liked our Facebook page, please do so, as we regularly post updates there. I ask all of you now to gather your hearts and minds for worship wherever you are this morning, with these opening words from the Song of Solomon. For now the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth. The time of singing has come. The fig tree puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom, they give forth fragrance. Happy spring, friends. If you'd like, join us in singing our opening hymn for the beauty of the earth. Join us, if you will, in our unison chalice lighting. The words are in the order of service we emailed this morning. We light this chalice for the light of truth, the warmth of love, and the fire of commitment. We light this symbol of our faith as we gather together. And now our doxology. Peace, good will on earth be sung.
Hello. Our story for today takes place deep in a tropical jungle, and it begins in the middle of the night, where the chief of the jungle, a mighty tiger, is sleeping until he's rudely woken up by a gecko. So Tiger opens one eye and says, "Gecko, what do you want? It's the middle of the night." And Gecko says, "I've come to complain." Well, Tiger almost just rolled over and went back to sleep, because what could Gecko have to complain about? He spent most of his time just being lazy, laying around. All he really did was sleep and eat. And when he was hungry, all he had to do was stick his tongue out and catch a mosquito, which were everywhere. But Tiger was patient. He was a really good leader in his jungle. So he took a deep breath and said, "What's troubling you, Gecko?" "It's the fireflies. All night long, they fly around, they flash their lights in my eyes, they keep me awake, flashing and flickering. I haven't slept for days, and it's making me very grumpy. You're the chief of the jungle, so you need to make them stop." Tiger stifled a yawn and said, okay, Gecko, because what else can you say to someone who's that grumpy? He says, "I'll go talk to the fireflies." So Tiger sighs and he heads off to find the fireflies. He walks out into the wet jungle, into a marshy type area, and sees a whole group of fireflies flashing above all of the plants. So he wades over to them and he says, "Fireflies, Gecko says that you've been disturbing his sleep, flashing and flickering all night long. Is that true?" "Well, we do flash our lights all night long," said the fireflies, "but we didn't mean to disturb anyone. We're just passing along Woodpecker's message. We hear him drumming out a warning." "I see," said Tiger. "Then I'll go talk to Woodpecker." At the edge of the watery area, Tiger sees Woodpecker, and he is drumming against a tree. Rat-tat-tat, rat-tat-tat. "Woodpecker," Tiger winced. "The fireflies say that you're rapping and tapping, tapping and rapping, and drumming out a warning all night. Is that true?" "Of course," said Woodpecker, puffing up his feathers. "I provide a great service. Clearly, my efforts are not appreciated, though." And he looked down his long beak at Tiger. "Beetle rolls manure right across the path. I warn the jungle animals so no one steps in it. Without my drumming, who knows what a mess you'd all be in." "Oh," said Tiger. "Well, that is very helpful. Thank you." Tiger licked his nose and thought, and then said, "I'll go talk to Beetle." It was easy to spot Beetle on the jungle path. In the moonlight, his back glimmered like polished metal. "What is this?" Tiger asked Beetle. "Woodpecker says you're rolling a filthy mess all over the place." "Oh, yes, yes, I can't stop," Beetle replied, rolling a ball of dung right up to Tiger's paw. "Water buffalo drops huge piles all over the path. If I don't move some of it away, there'll be muck everywhere." Tiger lifted his paw, and Beetle bustled past. "Okay," said Tiger. "Thank you, Beetle. I'll go see Buffalo." So Tiger found Buffalo asleep in a pool of mud. "Buffalo!" Tiger roared, because at this point he was starting to get a little bit grumpy too. "Beetle says that you're leaving your manure all over the path. Is that true?" "Well, of course," said Buffalo. "I leave manure all over the path, but I'm trying to be helpful. Rain washes holes in the path every afternoon. I leave manure only to fill up the holes so no one trips and falls. If I didn't do that, I think someone could get hurt.
I see, said Tiger. That's actually very thoughtful of you.
Tiger twitched his tail. He wondered what to do. He was starting to lose patience. So he sighed and said, I'll go ahead and hear what Rain has to say. So Tiger set off to the highest mountain in the jungle, which was the home of Rain. He climbed and climbed and climbed. He went through the jungle, the scrub, and then he climbed some more until he was at the smooth grass of the mountain peak. And he stopped to catch his breath. And then he looked down. The sun was starting to rise. And what Tiger saw was jungle for miles and miles. There were bright, colorful flowers. He could hear streams of water trickling and tinkling down the mountain. He could see the bright green of the trees and the fields, and he could very faintly see the flick of the firefly's light. No need to ask why rain rains, Tiger said to himself. So he took a break, he got a drink, he rested, and then he headed back down the mountain to find Gecko. And by the time he did, it was starting to get dark again. And Gecko demanded of Tiger, did you talk to the fireflies? They're still flashing and flickering. Didn't you tell them to stop? Gecko, said Tiger. He spoke very slowly because he wanted Gecko to understand. The fireflies flash to pass on Woodpecker's warning. Woodpecker warns everyone to not step in beetle's dung. Beetle clears up the excess dung left by buffalo. Buffalo leaves manure in the path to fill up the holes made by rain. Rain makes holes in the path as he creates streams and lakes and puddles. Puddles where mosquitoes live. Oh, said Gecko. Gecko, what do you eat? Mosquitoes, said Gecko. So, said Tiger. Gecko thought for a minute and then slowly said, so, if rain stopped raining and buffalo stopped filling holes, and beetle stopped rolling dung, and woodpecker stopped drumming, and fireflies stopped flashing, I would have nothing to eat. Exactly, said Tiger. Gecko, everything in this world is connected. Go and live in peace with the fireflies. So Gecko found a high tree. He climbed up, stuck himself upside down underneath a branch, tried to get in a place where some leaves would cover his face. He closed his eyes and went to sleep. The fireflies flickered and flashed, and the tiger, worn out from his journey, snored. So last Wednesday was Earth Day, a day when all around the world people celebrate the Earth and all that it provides for us. So I know my kids had assignments from school and they talked a lot that day about the Earth. But did you know that for some UUs, they consider every day to be Earth Day? One of our seven Unitarian Universalist principles talks about the Earth. And that's what this story today reminded me of. So in simple language, the seventh principle says that we believe in caring for our planet Earth and every living thing that shares it with us. In more complex language, that principle says that we affirm and promote respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. So whether you prefer the simple or complex language, I wonder if you believe those ideas to be true. And if you do, I wonder how you could make every day Earth Day.
As we prepare for a moment of prayer and meditation, I have a community announcement. I got a message this morning on my way to church that former member Chad Myers died. I ask that you hold tenderly his former spouse and his two children in your thoughts and prayers in the weeks and months to come. I also know all of you carry your own unique joys and sorrows. And so prepare yourself, as you naturally would, for prayer or meditation. Take a moment to take a mindful breath. Try to quiet your racing mind. And let us journey into silence with these words. Spirit of life, no matter how hard we work and no matter how much we worry, the world does not ever seem like a perfect place. The pain and suffering are still there. The homeless fill our streets. Young children abandon hope in the future. Every day people die from violence, disease, and starvation. And there are those inner torments of anger, loneliness, and grief. O gracious one, we know your love is our reality, but it is so easy to lose our focus. Let us acknowledge the burdens of our hearts. Let us acknowledge those in need. Let us acknowledge the work that is ours to do. And let us pray for the healing of the world and for the energy and clarity we need to go about doing it. And now let us meditate in silence together now. Amen. Please join in singing Spirit of Life. Thank you.
Today's reading is Isaiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. The word that Isaiah, son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be raised above the hills. All the nations shall stream to it. Many peoples shall come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that God may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. God shall judge between the nations, and shall make peace for many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore."
By my lights, we are now 7 weeks into this pandemic here in Wisconsin, which means many of us have spent more time indoors alone or with our spouses and children than is usual. I had a nightmare the other day in which this pandemic began in winter, and so I was stuck indoors without the option of a comfortable afternoon stroll or a morning run. I awoke from this nightmare more grateful for Wisconsin's sorry excuse for spring than ever before. When I venture out for a walk or one of those drives I've taken just to get the heck out of the house, I notice more people walking and riding bikes than in years past, or maybe I'm just paying closer attention this year. With my wife and daughter, I went out to the Dells the other day and saw more people there than I have ever seen before, sitting in little pods, practicing safe physical distancing, enjoying a picnic or a game of catch. With so many people sheltering in place throughout the world, scientists and citizens alike have begun noticing that the natural world is healing itself and reclaiming once domesticated areas. City dwellers accustomed to the continuous drone of cars and cranes and planes overhead are now able to hear birdsong for the first time in decades. In cities like New Delhi and Los Angeles that are infamous for their traffic and smog, residents are being treated to near empty highways and clear skies unlike anything in recent history. With humankind's near godlike power to remake the natural world in our image, we easily forget there lies in nature an awesome power for recreation. We are rightly impressed and wary of humankind's power for destruction, but we would be wise to remember just how amazing nature's power to heal and mend can be. As Julie mentioned, this past Wednesday was the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, that annual event established to show support for our shared and sacred world. Under normal circumstances, demonstrations and marches would have been held throughout the country, but this pandemic has shifted most activism indoors. The irony that people in the United States were sheltering in place on Earth Day wasn't lost on me. As I sat on my couch scrolling pictures of coyotes roaming near the Golden Gate Bridge in broad daylight, and seals resting on empty beaches in Spain, and deer sleeping on people's lawns in London, I couldn't help but think that nature really doesn't need people. Just look around. Turns out we're the ones who need nature. Even with so many great stories about nature's power, it's easy to despair. Every day, the number of COVID-19 cases increase, and at this point, the virus has claimed the lives of more than 50,000 people in the United States and nearly 200,000 people worldwide. Meanwhile, people like us, the living, worry about our health and that of our beloveds. We mourn or sit bored at home, waiting for who knows how long before we'll be free to return to whatever shreds of normalcy await. Whenever I turn my thoughts to the millions of people throughout this country sheltering in place, I am instantly humbled by their selfless and collective efforts to protect others. And I am routinely brought to tears when I read about all of the heroes in scrubs and grocery store aprons who risk their lives every day to help feed us and care for the sick and vulnerable. Whenever this is over, we should do everything and our power to ensure the essential workers are compensated accordingly. My heart goes out especially to the people who are most vulnerable, as this pandemic has revealed that even though this virus doesn't discriminate, it is wreaking the most devastation on the poor, on black and brown people, and on our nation's elders. That these facts exist prove that if inequalities aren't addressed in our nation now, something like this is certain to happen again. As Universalists, we believe that salvation is not individual. It is collective. We don't believe this because it looks good on a bumper sticker. We believe this because in the Hebrew Bible, whenever the poet of the Psalms or the prophet spoke of salvation, they always understood it to mean a force so mighty that it would draw the whole world together. The role of the prophet has always been to look back on what was and behold what is with a sober, rational mind and dare to imagine new possibilities better than what a dominant culture suggests. Prophets say things like, "Let justice roll down like waters." Prophets stare their fellows in the face and say that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. They say that the first shall be last and the last shall be first. But I don't hear a lot of prophetic speech these days. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't hear someone ask, "When will we go back to normal?" In my mind, all those people who broke safer at home restrictions to pressure their governors to rush to reopen their states for commerce were, at least in part, motivated by politics. But I suspect that many of them were and are motivated by an understandable lust for normalcy. Who doesn't want to return to the days when you could just stroll down Main Street and shop? Who doesn't want to take their friends out to dinner? Who doesn't want to go to a baseball game? Who doesn't want to be there when their child is born? We all do. But this restlessness and this hunger for normalcy is also a sign of something deeper. Every day, the nightly news reminds us that in New York City, there are mass graves filled with the unclaimed dead. There are refrigerated trucks filled with the bodies of the dead, and the medicines used to treat the symptoms of this virus are already running low. On a global scale, humankind is collectively having to deal with the fact that we are impermanent. As tempting as it is to want to avoid this reality, it is our duty as people of faith, a tradition that weaves its way through Abraham and Ruth and Jesus and Dorothy Day and Sojourner Truth and Martin Luther King, we have been called to reclaim the prophetic tradition here and now, because the prophetic imagination is the only human artistry capable of helping us deal with this devastating loss. Only honest, prophetic speech can liberate us from apathy and the desire to return to normal, as if there ever was such a thing. Writing in the pages of The Atlantic, Ed Young ends his most recent essay with these words: "As the rest of the U.S. economy comes to terms with the same restless impermanence, it must abandon the question, when do we go back to normal? That outlook ignores the immense disparities in what different Americans experience as normal. It wastes the rare opportunity to reimagine what a fairer and less vulnerable society might look like. It glosses over the ongoing nature of the coronavirus threat. There is no going back. The only way out is through, past a turbulent spring, across an unusual summer, and into an unsettled year beyond." My friends, what awaits us in that unsettled year beyond is a mystery we all wish to know. But if we continue asking that question, we will waste what we are being called to do right now, which is this: to create a fairer society, one where minority and disabled communities don't get sicker than the rest of us. A society that takes seriously the fact that American capitalism has failed, not once, but twice in the past 12 years. A society that takes seriously our absolute dependence on the natural world and responds accordingly with wholesome policies that protect the only planet we will ever get. Some people look at this crisis and see some of its efforts to curb the spread of coronavirus as an attack on personal freedom. Some see it as divine punishment. Some see it as something people had coming for not wearing a mask in public or for washing their hands for just 19 of the recommended 20 seconds. What all of these theories share is a very human phenomenon known as want. We want to know how this all began. We want to know why some people get it and others don't. We all want to know when this will end. In Barbara Kingsolver's essay, High Tide in Tucson, she writes, "Want is a thing that unfurls unbidden like fungus, opening large upon itself, stopless, filling the sky. But needs, from one day to the next, are few enough to fit in a bucket, with room enough left to rattle like bristlebrush in a dry wind." The question we should be asking isn't what we want, but rather what is needed. Most of us have willingly, but let's admit somewhat begrudgingly, given up the luxury of worshiping together and shopping and traveling and visiting people in hospitals. We've given up conveniences and some of the very things that make life worth living. We've given up schools. We've given up playgrounds and kisses and hugs and cocktail parties and barbecues. Nurses and doctors and stockers and tellers have given up sleeping with their lovers and holding their children for what? We've done it for each other. We do this so that we and others might live. The same prophetic tradition that tells us to let justice roll down like waters tells us that we don't belong to ourselves, but that we belong to each other. We belong to a world of which we are all part. Now might be a good time for all of us to ask ourselves just what we think people are for. Are people meant for the unemployment line? Are people meant to go hungry? Are people meant to subdue and dominate the planet, as that very bad translation of Genesis suggests? Or are we meant to live, as it says in the actual Hebrew, to till and tend creation? Are we meant to regard the earth as something worthy of our service? Are we meant to beat swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, like the prophet said? Are we meant to create a society that acknowledges our connection and interconnection to one another? In the same essay by Barbara Kingsolver I quoted earlier, she writes this: "Every one of us is called upon, probably many times, to start a new life, a frightening diagnosis, a marriage, a move, loss of a job or a limb or a loved one, a graduation, bringing a new baby home. It's impossible to think at first how this will all be possible. Eventually, what moves it all forward is the subterranean ebb and flow of being alive among the living. In my own worst seasons, I've come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard at a single glorious thing, a flame of a red geranium outside my bedroom window, and then another, my daughter in a yellow dress, and another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon, until I learn to be in love with life again, like a stroke victim retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills. I have taught myself joy over and over again. In this colorless moment in time, in a world beset by despair, we must force ourselves to look hard for glorious things. But they're there, in the world that nurtures and inspires us and amongst the fellows we share life with. They're at hospital beds and in bedrooms turned into classrooms. They're selling you your groceries and farming the land and milking the cows. Let us give thanks for this life by being the prophets of righteousness our faith calls us to be. Let us be citizens and stewards of creation and each other. And let us mourn and learn joy over and over again. Amen." Please join in singing "Blue Boat Home."
Oh,
wherever you are, reach out with your hearts. And may the truth that sets us free, and the hope that never dies, and the love that casts out fear lead us forward together until the day spring breaks and all shadows flee away.